Zadkins v. Pickard. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the IDOC employees. This is a case about applying the liberal pleading rules to the qualified immunity defense.
But what about this death issue? You're way over your 90 days. What's going on here?
In the district court or up here?
In the district court.
In the district court, there...
You don't have a client.
Your Honor, I represent the department employees.
I'm sorry. I have it backwards. I'm sorry. That's a question directed to your opponent. Although you can ask. So there's a hearing Monday,
We've presented a motion.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Yes. So that hearing is Monday.
And you are taking the position that the case should be dismissed because of the death of Atkins and the failure to find a substitute within 90 days. Is that the department's position?
Your Honor, I'm actually not precisely familiar with the district court rule, but I understand actually that as I understand it right now, no official suggestion of death has been filed except for ours, and so it may be, depending on what the district court says, that the 90-day clock is just starting to run as opposed to starting to run with the plaintiff's motion in December. But I'm not sure. I think that's something that Judge Shader has to work out.
Go ahead with your argument.
But I would say that with regard to the death, it may well be that the plaintiff will be completely unable to prove his case because he won't be able to present any evidence in his favor. But with regard to the qualified immunity defense, there are three reasons that the qualified immunity defense should not be stricken. The defendant's answer put the plaintiff on notice that we were raising this qualified immunity defense, which unlike a normal defense, goes to both the merits in the first prong of the Saucer analysis, and in the second puts the onus on the plaintiff to prove that the law is clearly established. So unlike, what the district court talked about in terms of a proper affirmative defense, this kind of affirmative defense, you have to take the Supreme Court said in Kelly, you have to take the answer as true, not the complaint. What the district court...
Doesn't it have to be a procedure by which a person can establish that he's not the person that the government is actually intending to detain?
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, there was plenty of process here. I mean, and this is really the crux of the case.
What could he have done that he didn't do to get a prompter determination?
Well, there are several things he could have done. One, the easiest thing, or the most immediate solution would have been to go to the circuit court and ask for a TRO or immediate mandamus relief. He could have gone into the circuit court. This is part of the process that's available, and this is why really the district court here got it completely wrong. There is plenty of process here. The whole question is not about deprivation of liberty. We know that a deprivation of liberty alone is an unconstitutional. It's the deprivation of liberty without process. And Baker says, it depends on what process is afforded by state procedures. Here we have five, actually. We have the process that took place. There was the preliminary hearing within 7 days at which, from what our evidence would show, plaintiff did not, in fact, raise any misidentification claim. There's also the Department of Corrections' own grievance system. Plaintiff filed a grievance challenging the preliminary hearing, and yet he didn't mention identification. And the evidence, we would produce evidence with his grievance to show that. Plaintiff had either a TRO, declaratory relief action in circuit court. He also had the possibility of a mandamus in circuit court. And in addition, he had a post-deprivation remedy in the court of claims. So the state affords, as Baker requires, the state afforded plaintiff plenty of process to remedy either immediately or post the deprivation.
The court of claims action is an adequate substitute for what, you spend several years in prison and then you bring a court of claims suit?
Well, Your Honor, if
doesn't sound very good.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, it's a sovereign immunity question. I mean, the fact that the state has created the court of claims means that there is a post-deprivation remedy. I mean, the state...
But it's not an adequate remedy, right?
No, it's certainly adequate. I mean, the plaintiff
So you could abolish habeas corpus and say if people are unlawfully imprisoned for the rest of their life, something like that, they can go to the court of claims and get a money judgment to restore them to where they would. No, that doesn't make sense.
Your Honor, I mean, there's no difference between
You can't be serious in thinking that a money remedy is an adequate substitute for being indefinitely imprisoned.
What I'm saying is, in this case, a court of claims would provide damages, the same kind of damages that either a circuit court.
You're not engaging my point. You really think that money damages are a substitute for indefinite imprisonment?
Yes.
Well, I don't get that. So if you were put away for 20 years on suspicion of being William Atkins, mm-hmm. you would be content because you'd know at the end of this time you could go to the court of claims and you could get a judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's no different.
You'd be fine. You'd be fine with that.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's no different from coming.
That's amazing.
Because, Your Honor, it's
no. I don't think you're really thinking about my question.
If I could complete my answer,
sure.
I am thinking about your question very hard because I am thinking that to get damages from the court of claims is no different from getting damages from the district
court. And you are indifferent between being imprisoned and being imprisoned and compensated at the end, and being given a proceeding that would avoid the imprisonment.
Your Honor, what I'm...
Are these as equivalent states of welfare for yourself?
What I'm saying is that the court has held that a post-deprivation remedy is sufficient to satisfy due process. Now,
that depends on the circumstances. If you're fired, yes, you're fired from a job, often post-deprivation remedy is quite adequate. But we don't think, nobody thinks, including yourself, that if you put a person in prison for, let's say, I mean, make it dramatic, for 20 years, that's fine. You don't have to have due process. You don't have to have a proceeding, right? You don't have a trial. You just arrest a person. You put them in prison. And you say, if this is wrongful and you shouldn't be in prison, then whenever you get out, 20 years, 30 years, what have you, you will be able to bring a suit for damages in the court of claims. And that will make you whole. And therefore, we don't have to provide any kind of a process, right?
Your Honor,
can't be your position.
My position, Your Honor?
Is that your position?
Is the question, do we not have to provide any do we have to provide nothing other than the post-deprivation remedy?
Right.
Under this court's precedent, no, we don't. But the... As I read Gunther,
you can't be serious.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'll be happy to go back and
look. You're suggesting that there is always a damages remedy which compensates for imprisonment, however protracted.
From my reading of the case law, that's true. But Your Honor, in addition to the post-deprivation remedy here, there were concurrent remedies.
I'm just amazed you think the post-deprivation remedy is adequate by itself. But anyway,
let me ask you a question. I'm just perplexed by how something like this happens.
Mm-hmm.
Atkins gets arrested. There's a parole warrant. Apparently, the Atkins who was on parole, whether it's this one or not, has been on parole for 4 years. So he has a parole officer who has looked him in the eye and knows this is this is Atkins or this is Judge Posner.
Mm-hmm.
When he's arrested and he says, I'm not the Atkins who's on parole here, why isn't that real simple to get to the bottom of it? You call the parole officer in and say, look at the guy in the cell, is this your man? And he says, oh, you got the wrong guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very distinguished 70-year-old, 68-year-old judge. He's somebody else. Why wouldn't that be the way something like this would be resolved in this particular case? Mm-hmm. It just is unbelievable to me that he spent 30... If he's the wrong guy, that he spent 37 days in jail.
Your Honor, there are procedures in place to verify the identity of someone who's arrested on a parole warrant. And those are the ones that we suggested in our brief. The arresting...
Judge Evans is suggesting something simpler, which is to ask the parole agent to take a look at the guy. And another alternative would be to check his fingerprints, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And
must be fingerprints of the parolee.
Yes, Your Honor.
Atkins has fingerprints?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why weren't they compared?
Your Honor, I believe that the evidence will show that they were compared.
Isn't that the issue here, Ms. Welch? This is all interesting dialogue, but isn't the question is that was the immunity granted too soon? I mean, denied on the pleadings too soon?
Precisely,
right.
Your
so
Honor.
So whether we that's the issue here.
Precisely,
whether the judge
Honor.
Gave any deference to the reasonable inferences that you claim in your pleadings below.
Precisely, Your Honor. That is the question.
But that issue is ordinarily raised by you filing a motion for summary judgment claiming qualified immunity, not by the defense filing a motion to strike a affirmative defense of qualified immunity in your answer.
Precisely, Your Honor, because it's necessary to develop the facts.
Right.
And so, I mean, we... From between when we filed the answer and when we filed our complaint, certainly for example, the city of Chicago presented evidence to the district court that showed, for example, that they had identified the plaintiff as the person named in the warrant, that they had checked to see that he used 1971 as his birth date under prior arrests. And so his claim that I'm the wrong guy because I wasn't born in 1971 is problematic because he has told the police he was born in 1971. So that's why, as Judge Flom is suggesting, at this juncture, the court, you know, pulled the trigger a little too early. There needs to be development of facts and development.
Why did you appeal, though? Why not wait and put in some evidence?
Your Honor, the district court struck our defense. It didn't. The court's decision saying there can be no question but that there was a duty here meant that the court, we understood the court not to be open to entertaining this defense in the future, regardless of what facts we would present. That's why we're here, so that we could be assured of being able to raise it.
Why didn't you test that and submit a motion to reconsider and say, you know, well, we did do the fingerprints and so on and so forth.
The city of Chicago's evidence came after we had already filed the notice of appeal. And Your Honor, I don't know that we would want to.
Premature. I don't understand what the rush was. You could have filed. You could have waited.
Well, Your Honor, then
evidence to the district judge, tell him he had acted prematurely. Wouldn't lose anything by doing that.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if that's true, because if we hadn't appealed that order and then we came back and tried to raise it again and he said, no, don't you remember, you should have appealed that order, and we came up here.
No, you can do that. You know our Fairley opinion, our reissued
right.
Fairley opinion?
Right.
You can always appeal from denial of a motion for summary judgment, even if you fail to appeal from the denial of the motion to dismiss.
That's true if qualified immunity is still on the table, but if the district court took qualified immunity off the table...
Take it off the table.
That's what we understood this order to do as a permanent thing.
How can a district permanently take something off the table?
Well, precisely, Your Honor. That's why we're here. I hope that I would be able to have some rebuttal time since...
Yeah, sure.
Thank
that's
you.
Fine. Thank
we
thank
ask the
you,
court
Ms.
to reverse.
Mr. Longo?
Good mornings to you, Your Honors. If a jailed person...
Well, I can barrage you now with
okay,
these questions
I'm, all
about
right, I'm
this
ready,
death
I'm ready.
business, which is so ridiculous.
I'm sorry, what's ridiculous?
This death business. Why? So you didn't discuss it in your briefs. So now what is the status of this?
Your Honor, Mr. Atkins was 29. It was a sudden death, so his wife and his little boy are not they're having a little bit of a difficult time. So I'm trying to balance somehow, trying to get the information I need.
What information do you need?
Well, we need to open up an estate. We need papers signed, et cetera, information of assets, et cetera. And we're getting it slowly, but I think it opens up wounds every time I call. And not only I think, I know. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm trying to balance the pain she's feeling with the same time trying to get the information. I'm getting it, but slowly. Certainly no advantage to me for the delay.
It's almost 4 months now. You're
saying
supposed
that.
To do it within 3 months, right? 90
well,
days.
Well, I believe it's from the time that you file your suggestion. Again, there's no reason for me not to have done it sooner. I'm making calls. It just comes slowly.
Well, what is this filing suggestion that you filed something?
And it was denied as premature. Just letting.
What does that mean? Premature? It's so strange. It's like saying he hadn't died yet. Is that would be premature? What was premature about it?
I just wanted to alert, you know, Mr. The district court judge as soon as I found out something. But I still at that time.
What I'm trying to understand: how can it be premature? Say my client died. And now, you know, I have to find a substitute. How can the judge say it's premature? What was his ground for thinking that was premature?
Because we were going to file the papers indicating that we had opened up the estate, et cetera, I imagine.
Well, I don't understand. You're supposed to file the suggestion of death, and then you have 90 days to find a substitute. You're not supposed to say, well, this person died, and I'm going to file a suggestion of death at some future time. I don't understand that. That just takes the 90 days and makes it indefinite. Person died, and in a couple of years I'll file a suggestion of death.
Mrs.
Doesn't
Atkins,
make any sense.
Mrs. Atkins will be the administrator.
But I don't understand this prematurity business. Person dies, you're obligated to, I would think you are obligated, of course you're obligated to inform the court as soon as you find out that there's no longer a client. You need a substitute. So you did that, what, December 6th?
In December, yes.
Well, it's now, you know, almost, it's now 120 days instead of 90 days. So what are you going to tell Judge Shader Monday?
I'm going to tell Judge Shader what I'm trying to do. I mean, she does want to pursue it. She's in pain. This was sudden. It wasn't like a sickness. He was 29. They have a little boy.
Can't you tell her? You know, she has to make up her mind in 90 days whether she wants to pursue the lawsuit.
No, she's already indicated that she has.
Well, then what's holding you up with the 90 days? I don't get it.
Your Honor,
you have 90 days to do this.
She's going through a lot of pain.
What does that have to do with the 90 days?
Your Honor, all I can do is tell you what I'm experiencing. She's a widow now. She has all kinds of new allegations and paperwork.
Every case with a suggestion of death, they're always survivors.
I'm not sure if it's common for someone to die suddenly at 29, ordinarily.
Well, even when people die at 70, their survivors are sometimes upset.
I understand. All I can tell you is what I'm trying to do.
Was his deposition ever taken?
No, it was.
How are you going to prove a case like this?
Well, just as I told Magistrate Keyes, I mean, what are my options? I could walk away and go into another case, but at the same time, I want to help to the extent that I can, Mrs. Atkins and the little boy. It's going to be difficult. There's no question. Would it be better for?
I mean, their defense, as I understand it, is this. Atkins either was the fellow on parole, or used enough different aliases and birth dates that they didn't violate his rights.
That's respectfully false. Number one, the Prisoner Review Board, within minutes, released him. The very same day. All they did is what Your Honors had suggested. You compare the information, which was in their own files. No immediate, no independent investigation was necessary.
Was he fingerprinted?
Yeah, yes. They had the photograph of the wanted William Atkins. They had his fingerprints. Mr. Atkins kept saying, just please compare my photograph with the wanted William Atkins and you'll see you have the wrong guy. Any reasonable officer would have done that. At least they would have. All he has to do is check the computer. There's the photograph. It comes right up on the screen. Or report it to a supervisor. Do something, but you don't ignore somebody for 37 days. Would a reasonable person ignore somebody's pleas for help for 37 days? I don't think so.
Mr. Longo, your suggestion of death filing lists William Atkins and Adam Atkins. Adam Atkins, a plaintiff in this case?
He is.
Wasn't he released?
He was.
So what's the cause? The van is stopped and the passenger is released and you brought a lawsuit? What's your claim with Adam Atkins?
Well, that's not part of our appeal.
I'm just wondering how
is it? Civil rights violations. They were approached him with gunpoint. They're coming from a laundromat. They pull him out of the car. They throw him against the vehicle. They throw him back into the police car. And they kept asking, what did we do? They never received a traffic ticket of any kind. They were stopped in the middle of the street. For what? And again, even Adam Atkins told the police when they were in the police car, look on the screen. That's not my brother. And in fact, Mr. Atkins, William Atkins, was stopped 6 months earlier by the Chicago Police Department in March. They didn't misidentify him because he wasn't the wanted William Atkins. And the Prisoner Review Board determined that quickly and released him the very same day.
Why did the district judge strike the defense? Why didn't he just say that at this juncture there wasn't enough indication of reasonable behavior on the part of the defendants to warrant a finding of immunity?
Because there was an established right in 2003, and it was clearly established. And the defendants presented absolutely. They've had 4 years.
What is established is that the government has a duty to ascertain the identity of the defendant. So, but
no procedure.
But there are disagreements as to what went on. So Ms. Welsh says, well, he could have, filed a proceeding in the circuit court.
I guess if you're an attorney or if you have knowledge of the law, et cetera, if you have the funds to do that, but all they had to do was compare photographs. That's what he asked them to do. Would have taken 2 minutes.
No, what I asked earlier, Ms. Welch, the usual procedure is the governmental entity moves for summary judgment based on qualified immunity.
Or moves to dismiss.
Or moves to dismiss, and then you respond to it. This is a little unusual, I think, that you brought a motion to strike an affirmative defense. I'm curious why you did that, as opposed to letting this thing work out however it was going to work out.
Precisely for
sometimes people raise a qualified immunity defense in an answer and then through discovery decide their facts in dispute or something, so qualified immunity is not going to be appropriate here, at least at the summary judgment stage. So it's just going to sit there in the back of the case as an issue sometimes down the road you might have to tackle.
Well, I'd have to think about what I did 2 years ago, whenever it was. But if I remember correctly, the documents I received pre-discovery rules, there was nothing there that supported them. They presented nothing in their response to say, well, wait a minute. Here's a photograph that establishes that this is the guy we wanted. In fact, they released him. I mean, there's nothing, no fingerprints. I mean, they're not saying the fingerprints establish this and that. It's been 4 years. Never have they said that. Nor do they say it today. So there's really no reason to have something that is non-existent. It was a clearly
had they moved to dismiss on Had the defendants moved to dismiss on immunity grounds?
No, they did not. No, they did not. And ordinarily, they would have.
So you've caused this appeal, right?
No, I didn't cause
the appeal. By filing a motion to strike.
They could have waited.
By winning, you caused the appeal.
Yes. They could have waited.
Since they hadn't moved to dismiss, there really was no reason for you to precipitate such a proceeding.
Well, again, I'd like to clarify the pleadings, see what we need to prove and not prove. But still, the law was established. I saw the documents that they produced. So let's move forward. Why drag it on?
It's not moving forward. It's moving into an appeal. Striking an ordinary, affirmative defense.
They could have waited. I didn't think they would immediately appeal. Just didn't.
Why did you think they wouldn't immediately appeal? They always immediately appeal. Why would you think they wouldn't?
Well, precisely for the reason that we wait to the end of the case.
Ms. Welsh explained. Well, she's worried now. The thing's been struck. Her defense has been struck, and if she waits a year to. Maybe she'll get into trouble because she doesn't have a defense anymore.
I don't see how that could happen if something should develop. They've had 4 years for something to develop.
She's responsible for this appeal. It's a big mistake.
The law was established at the time that the district court agreed with it. They presented no facts.
I understand. When you try to strike an affirmative defense, which is a ground for an interlocutory appeal, you're buying yourself defending an appeal quite unnecessarily, pointlessly.
Your Honor, they could have filed a motion to reconsider, present these facts, or this is the discovery we need.
They're required to file a motion to reconsider.
Your Honor, I think it's important that they have not established any facts whatsoever, even in their brief, to say that had we been able to proceed, we would have been able to establish this, this, that, and that, such as the photographs establish this, the fingerprints establish it. If anything, reasonable officers would not have...
Filing this motion when you did, why would they have to do all those things? I mean, this is the embryonic stage of this lawsuit.
It had been several months since it. I don't exactly recall.
You're saying now that by filing a motion to strike, you can accelerate their preparation of a motion for summary judgment. You can force them to present the evidence that they would present if they were moving for summary judgment.
Your Honor, they presented their documents in the pre-discovery rules, and they're required to do that. Now, if there was something there that somehow established that they could somehow come up with a defense, then, then they would have raised it, and there was nothing there. Again, the Prisoner Review Board released him.
Now, you're saying that... No, come on. You're trying to say that by filing a motion to strike, you can... affect their decision whether to appeal from denial of the motion to dismiss or appeal from a denial of the motion for summary judgment.
Or wait to the end of the case to appeal. Appeal everything all at once. I mean, I realize they have a right to immediate appeal.
That's the problem. You enable them to take an interlocutory appeal. That doesn't make any sense. It just means you're defending another appeal.
They could have waited to the end of the
case. But they didn't.
Right,
I
understand.
You couldn't make them wait. All you could do would give them an opportunity for an interlocutory appeal that they would not otherwise have had since they hadn't filed a motion to dismiss.
And if this case goes back to the district court 6 months, a year from now, the state files a summary judgment motion based on qualified immunity and loses, they're going to be right back here. At that time, the record will be more complete on what the facts are here. But it just seems like it's pretty unnecessary. Maybe it's Judge Shader just sort of sent one sentence and said, I'm not going to rule on a motion to strike this affirmative defense. We'll see you next week.
But again, the evidence pretty much establishes that There was a clearly defined right in 2003, and reasonable officers would have taken some action. So what?
Well, but see,
they denied.
You know, everybody agrees that you can't lock somebody up if that's not the correct person. But Ms. Welch says that there was a hearing 7 days after, and the issue of identity was not raised. I don't know if that's true or not, or how that we look at the record, but all those kind of things are percolating under the surface of this case and have to be resolved by somebody sometime.
For one thing, it was raised, but even if it were not, being in jail for 7 days, by the way, the hearing was supposed to be on the 10th day, November 10th. It was moved up without notice to Mr. Atkins, but that's not an issue here on
Listen,
appeal.
Listen, don't get me wrong. I sympathize with you or Mr. Atkins if he was held in jail for 37 days and he was the wrong guy. And that shouldn't happen. But whether it did happen here or how the law on qualified immunity is to be played out, this is all bollock stump as far as I'm concerned.
I'm sorry, this is all what?
Bollock stump.
Bollocks. That's a Milwaukee word.
I went to Marquette.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Longo.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Welch, how much time does she have? No time. Do you have anything you'd like to say? Give you a couple of minutes.
I would like to mention, I think, five facts in five cases. Just the five facts that we would show include that the plaintiff had tattoos and other identifiers that matched the sought-for person. Chicago arrested plaintiff and determined that he was, in fact, the person named in the warrant. When IDOC took custody of the plaintiff,
why not have the parole officer identify him?
In fact, Your Honor, he was fingerprinted.
Pardon?
He was fingerprinted.
No, that's not the question.
I'm sorry. Why not do that?
Parole officer.
The warrant doesn't name, I believe, who the parole officer is, so that... And I believe that plaintiff was taken to a facility remote from his parole officer when he
from his parole officer?
Well, he was arrested in Chicago, which I presume is where his parole officer was. And he was then, after he was arrested in Chicago, he was taken to, I believe it was Stateville or Pontiac, I'm not sure. But wherever it was an institution
why not
remote.
Call the parole officer before you ship him away.
Perhaps, Your Honor, that would be a better solution, but it's not the only constitutional solution here.
Now, what about the fingerprints, right?
His fingerprints, to my knowledge, he was fingerprinted both by the Chicago police and by IDOC.
And what did those show on the, as compared to the 1999 parolee Atkins?
Whoever took the fingerprints when he came into IDOC custody determined, perhaps wrongly, I don't know, that he was in fact the person who was named in the warrant.
But he compared the fingerprints to the fingerprints of the parolee and they were identical?
I know that that's the process that's used. Again, I don't know that either he didn't make a mistake or maybe he didn't do it or maybe I don't know. I just know what the process is.
You informed Judge Shader that you thought this was premature, did you not?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. In our motion, in our response to the motion, we said that we needed factual development. And the factual development is shown, for example, that the PRB, the Prisoner Review Board, released him not because of misidentification, but for another reason. And similarly, he was held over at the preliminary hearing, not because of any misidentification, because he didn't raise it, which is what our evidence would show. So those facts.
Do you acknowledge that it's a different person from the parolee, or are you still unsure about that?
I am unsure about that. There seems to be evidence going both ways.
Haven't his fingerprints been sent to the FBI to be compared with the parolees?
Not to the FBI, no, Your Honor. I mean, sent them.
That's the standard way in which, you know, fingerprint identification is made by the FBI, right? Send them to fingerprints and they compare them.
I would think. I mean, we have sent them to the state police, which is what is generally done within the state. I know. So, but there seems to be...
Isn't the Chicago Police Department a Bureau of Identification?
Yes, Your Honor.
Prints and themselves? Without,
yes, yes, Your Honor.
Not,
and
it's not a difficult thing to do, is it? If you know,
right.
If you're a fingerprint technician, they do this all the time.
I would think so, Your Honor. And yet the Chicago Police presumably did check his fingerprints and did determine that...
Well, you can't tell us... You always these presumablys. And, you can't tell us whether... This is the same guy or not?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I don't have personal knowledge of what the city of Chicago did. I can only assume that they did what Hernandez,
well,
you know, they followed
the... Why don't you have personal knowledge?
Because I'm not
really
the...
preposterous. I mean, it's one thing to have this screw up in 37 days. That's pretty implausible. But how long has it been now since he was arrested?
2003, but he didn't file until 2005.
So it's been 4 years? Or 3 years?
Yes, but he was released, to my knowledge, from the documents I've seen, he was released not because of misidentification.
Well, 3 years to determine whether his fingerprints match that of the parolee.
Your Honor, I don't think we started to try to... I mean, certainly we weren't on notice that we
okay,
were...
Until 2005, so it's been a year...
Until he sued, right.
2 years.
Correct.
It doesn't take that long to check people's fingerprints.
Our initial determinations made it appear that he was, in fact, the right guy. But we have continued to develop the evidence to...
It's one of the most wasteful litigations I've seen in a long time.
We agree, Your Honor, because we believe that the reason he was released was not because of any misidentification. And if I may just briefly, the law that was clearly established in 2003 and even today is that under due process you look at the flexible balancing test. You look at the interest, you look at the process that is offered by the state, and you look at the cost. And in Hernandez, the cost of additional procedures. And Hernandez said that the cost of the additional requirement that everybody who is receives a claim of misidentification to follow up on that, the cost to the state is far too high because a guilty person might be released. And in addition, if every single guard who is told, and I'm sure this happens constantly, I am not the right guy, and every single guard had to call the records office to verify this, the cost to the state in lost time would just be astronomical. And that's why Hernandez is really the case on point here, coupled with Baker. It's the whatever process the state provides. And here the state provide both contemporaneous process, the preliminary hearing, circuit court actions for mandamus and a TRO, and also the post-deprivation relief. All of the process that the state affords means that the law was clearly established, in fact, that plaintiff didn't have a due process claim. And for that reason, in fact, the district court should perhaps not just have not struck the defense, but in fact dismissed. We ask at the very least that the court reverse the decision. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Welsh and Mr. Longo.